Welcome to Come and See, your podcast for finding truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. With host and founder, Richard Case, and co-host and retreat leader, Kathy Riccone. Jesus reminds us to watch for the signs of his return. Today, we will explore further what we are seeing in our times that line up with what signs he said would indicate the potential of the end and his return. We will also discuss the practical meaning of this as we watch and as a remnant prepare as he so leads. And now your host, Richard Case.
Welcome, everybody. This is End Times Friday, and this is now part two of talking to our good friends from Israel, Eric and Rabbi Ephraim, and we're just so privileged. And if you didn't listen, go back to get last week's an update on all the detail of really what happened over there and how it went, and the fact that there's a relief now because that was always overhanging Israel. If they get a nuclear weapon, that's not good. And so it was a matter of how do we do it, when do we do it, and we just saw how amazing this happened. So we have some big questions before, and Denny has some questions. But one question I did have, Eric, was the IDF and your forces took out. We heard they took out almost every military leader in Iran. Is that actually happened? Did that happen?
Well, it depends on how. The top echelon was pretty much eliminated. That's correct. In both the army and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. I'm sorry, Islamic Revolutionary Guard is what it's called. But of course, they have, subordinates who are available to replace them. And I think many of those positions have been replaced already. And what happened was that, and this was a very smooth operation by the Mossad, that basically most of them were all in the same place at the same time, which is unusual. And it was just a manipulation of circumstances by the Mossad. They basically made all the other places they could meet unavailable. And so they met there and then they took them out. That's really kind of what happened.
That's amazing.
But of course, they have replacements and those replacements are in place now. But, people would say, well, assassinations don't always work because these people in a democracy like the United States, where you have command and control and you have subordinates who get promoted on a regular basis and replacing their superior commanders, this is not the world of Iran. Iran is a dictatorship. It's a theocracy. The supreme leader had a series of advisors, almost all military around him, who he's trusted over the years. I'm not sure how many people understand that Ali Khamenei, who's the current supreme leader, took office like in 1990 when the previous Ayatollah died of natural causes. And he cut his teeth in the Iraq-Iran war and made many friends, you might call them, through the Islamic Revolutionary Guard during that war. And these are the people he put around him. Soleimani was assassinated by President Trump during his first term. So all these people were well trusted by the supreme leader. He knew who he was talking to, who was aggressive, who was too conservative, and how to trust their opinions in making a decision. And everything gets decided by the supreme leader. Well, when you take all those advisors away and they're gone, who does he trust?
Yeah.
Really, he had no one to trust. So it was very, very effective policy by the IDF.
Eric, there were also scientists that were taken out, probably more difficult because you don't have that kind of hierarchy there.
Right. So they estimate that they took, over the years, the Mossad has been active in assassinating top nuclear scientists in Iran who had very senior positions in the project, including, one who's called like the Oppenheimer of Iran, I mean, in fact, it was even disclosed recently that one of them was not only kidnapped by the Mossad, but he was interrogated on Iranian soil before he was killed. So wow. So a lot of these, I think it was estimated when an article I read, there are roughly 300 scientists altogether, scientists and engineers, working in one capacity or another on the nuclear project, whether it's making centrifuges or a nuclear detonation system or the weapon or the delivery system, whatever. It involves roughly 300 people. Out of those, the top 15 to 20 have now been killed. Okay. So I think it would be, I'm not sure I know enough to say whether the basic knowledge is now Well, there's one more piece of information. If you may remember, I think it was like around 9 years ago, Prime Minister Netanyahu was proudly displaying to the world this you know, truckload of documents, hard copy documents that the Mossad had actually literally stolen from a military facility in Iran and transported them by air back to Israel. And all those documents had detailed plans. They had blueprints of the Fordow facility. So this is how they knew where all these facilities were and how they were constructed. Well, I read, I don't know if I believe it or not, that there was one second set of those documents which were basically destroyed, set afire by an Israeli Air Force attack. So there's some claims that all the blueprints for making the bomb and so on may have been lost, but I'm a bit skeptical that that's really what's happened. So now you have like the second and third tier scientists who need to reconstruct sort of this recipe, if you will, for the bomb. And it's not so simple. I'm not saying that they can't reconstruct all the knowledge that they had before. They can, but it'll take time. So all these people who are running around the United States saying they're going to have a bomb in a few months now really don't know what they're talking about. It's going to take a lot longer. I don't know. It'll take a year, 2 years, 4 years. I don't know. It'll take a while. And there's lots that can happen in that time frame.
And it might be harder for them to recruit top nuclear scientists now under these conditions.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know, Danny, you had, as we think about what's next, you had some good questions that you could ask, and we can kind of see where it goes. But you know, it's about the political position of Netanyahu, Gaza, all of this happening. You know, what do you think happened? I think the way you framed it up is good. So why don't you go ahead and, you know, kind of ask those questions?
Well, Eric, you and Ephraim have talked about the very precarious standing of Netanyahu all the months and months that we've been meeting. And I did read an article that was talking about whether or not there's been a war bump and what that means going forward. And I'm also interested in this new relationship between Netanyahu and Trump, not just because of this war, but what must have been going on privately and secretively all along. And even the question that was raised here at one point about Netanyahu being part of trying to negotiate a settlement between Russia and Ukraine. What would you say about Netanyahu now versus 6 months ago? And, you know, has anything really changed there in the opinion of Israelis?
Well, you know, there polls are taken here all the time. Israeli polls you have to be very skeptical of, because I wouldn't call them very scientific. They ask questions, and depending on how you ask the question, you get the answer you want or don't want. All that being said, I think it's quite clear that his rating in the polls have gone up. His party has gone up in terms of, if there was an election theoretically held tomorrow, the number of seats in the Knesset, in the parliament, would rise compared to where it was. And so there's, and I would say, even those who've been protesting in the streets will reluctantly give him credit for what was accomplished. I don't think it's fair to credit him with what the Mossad did. That's been going on through multiple terms for many, many years under different leadership and within the Mossad. While, you know, yeah, the leader can take credit for a successful victory in a war, the man also was the prime minister when Hamas attacked on October 7th, and he still doesn't stand up and take, you know, responsibility for that at the same time. And everyone here is aware of both, okay? Mm. You can't stand up and take credit for what your army just accomplished in the victory and then deny you had anything to do with its failure a year and a half earlier. You can't have it both ways. Having said all that, I think there's a general appreciation of the skills that it takes from Prime Minister Netanyahu in working with President Trump. It's President Trump is not an easy man to understand, or how to understand what motivates him and how to get him to understand your position and why it's legitimate. But there's a skill in that, and I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has worked that angle quite well. Whether another individual running the country could have done it as well as him, it's probably not. Probably there was no one here as qualified as he was, knowing all the dynamics in Washington, having worked in Washington before, could have played this quite as effectively as the prime minister has. That being said, you know, his coalition still struggles and still has a lot of problems. And I personally, I don't think they're, you know, we're in a parliamentary democracy here in Israel, kind of modeled after the British system, for better or worse. And a government stays in power as long, up until for a maximum period of 4 years. And it's possible for the government to fall prior to that time if it fails a vote of confidence in the parliament. Given the circumstances, my guess is that this government will last its term, even though it has a lot of problems. And that means that the next set of elections will be taking place in a bit more than a year, but campaigning will start in about a year's time. And the elections will be in about 15 months type of time frame. It's when the next elections are scheduled. How Prime Minister Netanyahu does in that election depends on a lot of things that can happen between now and then. I really would be able to predict.
Rabbi, you have any input on that one as well, in terms of the people's view of all that?
Yeah, no, I agree with what Eric is saying. There's a lot of there's a super amount of pride in Israel's military accomplishments and a respect for Netanyahu and what he's accomplished, and there's also a lot of frustration. So yeah, it goes both ways. Israel, our voters are intelligent and they have good sense of history. And there's also, just to throw in the mix, there's a tremendous angst in the country about what's going on in Gaza. Whereas we still have many hostages, like 50 hostages dead and alive, and we have soldiers that are dying every day, and the war is going on and on and on. And that's one where the victory has not been so clear. The victory is clear that we have disarmed them to a very, very large extent and made them much of a less formidable threat. But there's, you know, there's a big split in the country about how we're handling the Hamas war, and that continues to grow the longer, you know, there's more and more people all the time that are just wanting to get out of Gaza. If a deal to get all the hostages can be accomplished, which is a really big question mark.
What's your guys of, I guess, potentials in Gaza of getting the hostages back, vacating? It's in ruins. So are they going to try to rebuild it? Will Hamas try to come back? Lots of dynamics. What's your thoughts about the next, you know, 6 to 12 months? What might happen there?
So what's happening now is Hamas's ability to control its population and to execute any kind of serious fighting is deteriorating quickly. And as a consequence, one could say that chaos is ensuing. Mm-hmm. You had a dictatorship, I mean, really brutal. Yeah. There are videos of Palestinian Arabs living in Gaza who will be just assassinated, killed in front of their parents because they're suspected of collaborating. All kinds of really ugly stuff. And as Hamas loses more and more of its power, there's a system of chaos ensuing. And the IDF is not trained, doesn't have the ability to be like a military occupier.
Yeah.
Okay. Like a normal, you know, and so the commanders and the leaders of the IDF are pushing back on the government, saying we can't run Gaza. That's not our job.
Right.
You know, so there needs to be an alternative. And I think that even not all the members of the current government, there are some extreme right wing members of this current government let me discount their opinions for the moment. Mm-hmm. I think many members of this current government would like to find a solution to the current situation in Gaza. And in their eyes, that means the leadership of Hamas leaves, not all of its members leave. They disarm. We can then, and the hostages are returned, and we can then talk about a reconstruction plan. But, you know, we don't get our wish, you know, and Hamas is not inclined to collaborate with trying to achieve something. This is a suicidal, a theocratic, fascist entity that prides itself in death, and it's created a death cult, literally a death cult in this area called Gaza, where they're perfectly happy to die, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you have this environment, they're not inclined to sort of say, okay, here are our guns, we're gonna go live someplace else, goodbye. They have no clear incentive to do that. So there's a bit of a stalemate. Now there are signs that there's going to be some interim deal, you know, another interim deal where we'll get half of the living hostages back, maybe 10 or so, and some dead bodies, and we'll have to release some nefarious terrorists out of the Israeli prisons. And then there'll be a ceasefire of some kind. And then there'll be this, what's being talked about now, but then there'll be a discussion of what happens afterwards. The intelligence community inside of Israel has pretty much stated publicly that you can, yes, you can get rid of the Hamas leaders today, and maybe they would agree to leave, maybe not. But as long as there are these Palestinian Arabs living in Gaza, there's going to be something like a Hamas. There's just there's no way to eliminate. It'll come up maybe a different name, or maybe it'll resurrect itself, reconstruct itself. You can't eliminate it permanently in its entirety. It's just impossible. And so they're advising to cut a deal, get the hostages back, and then what does it look like afterwards? What does it look like afterwards? Saudi Arabia has made it quite clear that they're not going to send a nickel to reconstruction of Gaza if Hamas is still in power, because they understand what that means. Mm-hmm. So the only entity in the Middle East, or around the world, I would say, that would show any inclination to send any money for reconstituting Gaza with Hamas having any kind of ability to influence events there would be Qatar. And Qatar has been from an Israeli perspective, Qatar is a very negative entity in the Middle East. They support the Muslim Brotherhood. They're sending lots of money to U.S. cousins there for clear reasons. And, they'll send a $10 billion aid to a French economy. And then 2 days later, Macron is saying all these nasty things about Israel.
Yeah.
So they throw money around very clearly to influence events around the world. So they could come in, but I'm not sure Israel would even permit it. So, and Israel will have a lot to say about how that happens. Hmm. So there'll be a stalemate in Gaza on how it gets reconstructed and who's going to pay for it and how. In the meantime, the people in Gaza will be living off of aid coming in and living in tents for quite a long time.
So probably there's a purpose of all parties, at least to try to get the hostages back and then have a ceasefire. But it'll still be a ruined country with terrorists that will still be there, and they'll rebuild. And Israel then just kind of watch it, just kind of see.
Well, I think there's a shift in Israeli view on how it deals with its enemies. Okay, in the past, up until October 7th, it would wait until something happened, an attack, a kidnapping, or a missile got fired. And then Israel was sending even situation in jets. On occasion, there was a war launched, like in 2006. But more often, it's like jets will go on and bomb a few places and then leave again. And that was according to the policy in Gaza. I don't think that policy will be reconstituted anymore. You can see it in play in Iran, in Lebanon. I'm not sure it's getting publicized in the United States, but I wouldn't say daily. But several times a week, there's you'll read about an explosion in a car driving along a highway in Lebanon that was carrying a Hezbollah leader and his two assistants. And poof, they're gone. That's Israel operating. And it's going to continue to operate this way. It's been doing it in Syria to a lesser extent because there's less leadership to take out. It's just, remnants of Assad's military storage and arsenal. And I'm sure there are discussions taking place. There took place this last week in Washington about Israel buying B-2 bombers, because it's going to want to be able to have this freedom of action in Iran also in the future, where it's not going to wait for an attack to take place again. It's going to initiate things to take out leaders. I think that's going to be a change in the Israeli policy going forward.
There's a discussion over here about expanding the Abrahamic Accords with other Middle Eastern nations that are particularly Sunnis. Is that discussed over there? Is there any thought about will they actually start to formally join up together with Israel and the United States?
Well, there's a lot of hope. There's been talk of Mauritania, of Indonesia, and of course Saudi Arabia, and there's some other players here in play. I think one of the most interesting ones is there's been a genuine fear in Israel that with Iran severely weakened and basically kicked out of Syria, the current leadership in Syria was largely armed by Turkey.
Yeah.
And Turkey, which used to be an ally of Israel, has gone the opposite way under the leadership of this current president for life, Tayyip Erdogan. And both he and the opposition party find that they're able to gather support from the public by trashing Israel and claiming it doing genocide all the time. So there's been a genuine fear inside of circles in Israeli army and the foreign policy experts that we just swapped out Iran for Turkey. And now is Turkey going to be doing things from inside Syria? But now there's a serious talk that Syria may come to some kind of deal. I don't think it'll be a peace agreement, but it'll be some sort of like they're talking about going back to the armistice agreement of 1973, which in the absence of a peace agreement would be okay with Israel. In fact, the peace agreement that Israel has with Egypt and Jordan is not what I would call a peace agreement. It's sort of more of a ceasefire. Population still taught to hate Jews, to hate Israel, but there's been no military conflict between the countries. And that's likely to be some kind of informal agreement. I think Syria can, the current leader can, will be very popular for long if it comes to a peace agreement with Israel. It's just the way. But there's serious talk that there's a deal being concocted between Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Syria, where Saudi Arabia will help fund the rebuilding of Syria rather than Turkey. And that would be actually a very good thing for Israel and the United States. And then the United States would relieve a lot of the sanctions on Syria. Syria can reconstruct itself, aligning itself with Saudi Arabia, which is much more palatable, not only to the United States, but also to Israel. And this can be some kind of three-way deal. And remains, I'm sure this was discussed in D.C. So,
Rabbi, is the population, are they aware of those kind of discussions of Abrahamic Accords and Saudi Arabia and what things are possible? Do they keep up on that and have any thoughts about that?
Well, it's definitely discussed in the news all the time, but there's usually not a whole lot of details that come along with that of what's being discussed and how serious. But you know, people are aware that there are discussions going on with Syria, and to everyone's surprise, that it seems to be a possibility. I did notice that Saudi Arabia, that used to say that there's no chance of them entering the Abraham Accords until there's a Palestinian state. It seems like their recent statements have been until the Gaza situation is resolved, which I think is a significant change, because Israel is not going to entertain a Palestinian state. That's like across the board, no one's entertaining that. So that's an absolute no starter. And perhaps that's dawned on them. And of course, they see their own self-interest in Saudi Arabia, sees their own self-interest in entering the Abraham Accords. But one, I think in the background of a lot of this, what Eric referred to also is that Israel has come to, since October 7th, a much clearer awareness. So this is something that was understood by, I'd say, the right wing in Israel, which, you know, approximately half the population, but less so by the left wing. But people in Israel are pretty aware now that this is a religious war, that it's not, we just want an independent state in the West Bank. That's not what it's about.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, it's never what they said it was about. They always said it was all about the destruction of Israel and, you know, killing as many Jews as possible in order to completely eradicate the state of Israel. That's, you know, we're clear on that now. Making compromises towards giving more power to Palestinians, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, that will be used to create more terror against us to help them towards their goal of our destruction is just, you know, not going to be entertained in this country much anymore. Yep. A lot less.
Well, thank you both for, go ahead, Denny. You have one more question.
I was just curious quickly, to what extent are world economics and tariffs and this emergence of Trump as the world negotiator using that leverage, to what extent does that play into these self-interests of these various countries?
So I have my opinion and I can't necessarily substantiate it. I believe that once we come to some resolution with Gaza, no final status, once I guess there's a clear ceasefire, I guess is the right way I would put it. I think the Israeli economy is going to skyrocket. And just to give you I have these European friends here, very dear friends who will come to, I don't know, you don't know how much goodwill you've lost in Europe. I said, Europe is in the Stone Age. You know, NVIDIA, who has become a household word now throughout the world, announced that they are building a 30,000 square meter, what is that? That's like a 300,000 square foot office building in the northern part of Israel So it can hire over 5,000 engineers in Israel.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't think the president, you know, Jensen Huang, the president of NVIDIA, is sitting there asking himself, wow, Gaza looks really demolished. I'm not going to, you know, I really don't think I can support Israel by building. He's building this facility because he knows he can find talent here. Okay.
Sure.
I know Apple quite well because I was an executive there for a while. They've announced that they're building their major AI chip design facility here in Herzliya, Israel, where they already have like 3,500 engineers, and they're looking for more. So, I mean, Israel is so aligned with the future of tech and everything else. There are like four major Israeli security companies, tech, you know, like cybersecurity, all primed to go IPO, okay? One of them I'm lucky to be an investor in. And they're all primed to go IPO in the next year, year and a half, okay? And when you're, you know, there was just France has this air show they used to put on, and now it's become more like a showcase for military hardware. And France put a black cloth around the Israeli exhibit. They claim because of politics. Don't believe them. It's because the French defense industry is scared that the Israeli defense industry has proven its acumen so substantially in this war that its sales are going to skyrocket. You know, Europe is now trying to live up to its obligations under NATO, finally, after 30 or 40 years. It took President Trump to put a figuratively a gun to their head to get them to actually raise their defense budgets where they should have been. And some of them are shopping here in Israel. And so I'm a firm believer that this country is going to zoom as soon as we bring this stuff to an end. I don't know. Ryan, what do you think?
I agree. On top of that, also, our young people are spectacular. People that have been serving,
that's right,
the army, people are being resilient against these threats. The young Israeli population is just spectacular. And without being too negative on the West, the trends in the West are not quite as positive as what's going on in Israel. So we're developing, you know, the young people in Israel just flying, and they're very goal oriented. They're smart. They're ambitious.
Yeah, most of us with gray hair are saying, take over the country already here.
That's great.
Great. Well, thank you so much again for all your insight. And it's been very enlightening to understand, particularly from your perspective, and the truth there of what's happening, what is happening. And we'll explore more as we continue to meet of all these factors now that are in play. What will that mean? And again, you know, for us, as we look at Israel being the center of attention and God's ultimate plan, personally, I always said, we can be assured, as everything was being discussed about nuclear, it ain't going to happen. I said, because the scriptures say it ain't going to happen. So however it happens, it ain't going to happen. So it's going to be interesting to see how what transpires next in terms of peace, or let's see, ceasefires. And I do believe that this has changed Israel's perspective on what to do now going forward. And their superior. I did hear, this is interesting, I saw a quote. This is from a senior Iranian leader. He was being interviewed, and he said, my whole life, my existence, my thinking, everything I do is to eliminate Israel. And I will be dedicated to that the rest of my life. He says, however, at the moment, we're not able to do that. He said, they're technically superior, way superior to all the rest of us. We can't get there. We can't get there right now. Now, I know it doesn't change their desire, but it's interesting what, you know, what I believe God has done, you know, for Israel. So anyway, thank you so much for sharing, and we're privileged to have you guys, and we're again grateful that you're hopefully able to have an enjoyable summer now that isn't under so much fear and worry. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us as always, and thank you to our listeners. If you have questions from today's broadcast, send them in to us at questions@abideministries.com, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Come and See, your podcast for truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. Send us your questions and comments, and tune in tomorrow for more answers to your personal questions about living life in God's truth. Remember, God's will is best and none better. His truth brings peace in this world of chaos.